To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Laura Wadlin here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Our guests tonight are Tiffany Koyama Lane and Mitch Green, who were elected to Portland City Council 2 weeks ago. Welcome, Tiffany and Mitch.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Tiffany will represent District 3, which is most of Southeast Portland and a little bit of Northeast. She is a third grade teacher at Sunnyside Environmental School. She and another city councilor-elect, Samir Kanal, will be the first Asian-American city councilors in Portland. She's a member of the Portland Association of Teachers and was a strike captain last year. Mitch will represent District 4, which covers the West Side and the Selwood-Moreland area. Until recently, Mitch was an energy economist at Bonneville Power, and he has also taught at Portland Community College and Portland State University. He's been a member of AFT and LIUNA 335. They are both socialists and will be serving alongside two leftists on City Council, Kanal and Angelita Murillo. You both ran for City Council for the first year after the council was expanded to 12 seats and restructured into four districts with three councilors each, who were selected through ranked choice voting. All four districts were up for election this year, and an astounding 92 candidates jumped into the race. In such a crowded field, what was different about your candidacies? Tiffany, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, so a lot of folks know me as Teacher Tiffany because I've been a public school educator for 16 years. And so that's something that really stood out about me. Also, my campaign was really rooted in the community. I'm someone who was encouraged by community members to run, and I'm someone that didn't think about that or necessarily wanted that myself. And I think that really showed in the many different groups that showed up to canvas and support in different ways.
Yeah, I love the question. You know, a big part of my motivation run in the first place was the understanding that despite the narratives about both District 4 as well as the kind of general mood of the city, I knew that it wasn't a rightward turn wave. I mean, there was a lot of people in this city who are either leftists, who are socialists, who are progressives, or you know, center-left Democrats of some sort, you know, you name it. The point being is I knew that with proportional ranked choice voting in a crowded field, the way to stand out was to sort of very clearly hang a sign out that said, hey, look at me, I'm a leftist, I'm running on leftist issues, and let's hit the ground running without apology on that. And I think it worked out.
So Oregonian reporter Shane Dixon Kavanaugh noted that your campaigns benefited from the unrivaled canvassing operation of the Portland Democratic Socialists of America. What's your connection to the DSA?
I was excited to see that Oregonian reporter acknowledge DSA's power and amazing ground game. My experience canvassing for Universal Preschool Now, which became Preschool for All, really exposed me to the organizing work of DSA. I got super jazzed about collecting signatures in 2020 with my mask. I was standing in front of Ace Hardware, running around Laurelhurst Park, getting people to sign to get that on the ballot. And that was really an amazing thing to be a part of. Also, the leading up to the strike, so the community work that I was doing as Portland Association of Teachers, my unions, I was the lead external organizer for a couple years leading up to the strike, and DSA members and leadership from DSA were incredibly supportive in showing up to those listening sessions and asking how to support, and also stood with us on the line when we were forced to go on strike. That was an incredibly formative experience, and I learned so much through that. What real solidarity between unions looks like, how important it is, how much stronger we are when we see ourselves as connected. And so those are two big experiences that really helped me feel more connected to DSA. I'm a member and am excited to continue to be a member and be engaged.
Yeah, my connection with the chapter, before I get into that, really, I was really grateful to see Shane Dixon Kavanaugh kind of give us that recognition, because I don't think that it was widely, you saw that widely in the local press, sort of like a kind of refusal to acknowledge the specific contributions and tactics that we can use as an organization to kind of build power. But I wasn't surprised, though, that DSA had a strong ground game, because I've been a member of the chapter for like 6 years. I joined in that kind of period. It wasn't right after Bernie lost, you know, and Trump won, but it was in that sort of period where I was trying to find my own way as a leftist outside of an organization, right? And kind of like banging my head against the wall, like thinking about politics. And then I joined because I saw Portland DSA mobilizing across the range of issues that were important to me, like anti-imperialism, being a veteran, an anti-war veteran, that was very important to me, and just kind of showing up for each other. And I saw the capacity, like the Preschool for Now example is a really good example. I saw the capacity of our chapter, you know, willingness to kind of coalesce around campaign work and fight to win. And so when we had two good campaigns, like Tiffany ran a great campaign and we ran a great campaign, combined with the DSA, it really was quite a force to be reckoned with. And it was, I think that's why members turned out, is they were inspired by that.
You both received a huge number of union endorsements. Why is that? And what do you have to offer the labor movement?
Well, I'm part of the labor movement. I'm a rank and file union member. I'm someone that has held leadership roles. I care a lot about my union, about union work. It's a core part of who I am and quite literally has changed the course of my life. I can say with confidence that I wouldn't have ran for office without my union's work that I have gotten to be part of. I mean, the organizing opportunities, the mentorship, there are folks, you know, that were from bargaining teams that just kept giving me the mic and saying, we see your potential. We think you should take this on. We think you should be part of this. And I think my record with OEA and PAT really speaks to my commitment to the labor struggle. I also know from all this work that it's really important to constantly ask, who's in the room? Let's be aware of that. Who's missing from the room? And, you know, to trust workers and center workers, to trust community facing staff and workers when they're talking about what work conditions are like. Those are things that I'm always going to keep centering and bringing us back to.
Yeah, I did pick up a lot of labor union endorsements, and I think that's for a couple different reasons. One, you know, when I would go into those endorsement interviews, I would talk about how we can build like a green and sustainable future with labor at the center and, you know, forward, because oftentimes labor and the environmental movement is pitted against each other. And I was able to offer a narrative that said, no, this is very much a united front type of concept. I also think that a lot of the unions that endorsed me did so because I wasn't afraid to say where I stood. You know, like rank and file unions are organizers. So their members are organizers, and they understand who their class enemies are and who they are. And I was able to say, look, I didn't go pursue any of the business endorsements because I want you to know very clearly where I stand. A lot of candidates will go out and say the same thing to every interest group. Like, you have my unwavering, you know, support. And it's like, that can't be true for labor and the business class at the same time. And that was my position on that. And I also was able to kind of go into that. I, you know, unlike Tiffany, I don't come out of the labor movement as an organizer, as a leader. My experience with it is more academic. Like, I studied it as an economist. I grew up in a labor household. But I learned about my labor politics in my socialist organization called DSA. I mean, so I think that's kind of, I think, what carried me on some of those endorsement decisions.
So how does your experience, you know, in the labor movement affect how you'll approach being a city councilor?
I'm already seeing it come through as we're having some initial conversations and meetings and, you know, just in interactions that I have, that something that I'm going to continue to bring up and bring us back to is how to keep the power with the people, how to keep the power with the larger group. You know, even as we're talking about the fact that we're going to decide on a council president, I'm thinking about, you know, how can we make sure that the power is really with the whole group? That it's not that everyone has to listen to that person, the president, but that the president has to be doing the most listening, has to be listening to everyone. How to make sure that we're pushing back when things kind of tend towards more hierarchical approaches, which is how what we're used to and is dominant culture and is what might feel comfortable and what we might lean back on or do when we're not being consciously thinking about that. And so that's something that I'm always going to be thinking about, how to make sure that the power is shared and it's power with, not power over. And I really I said this on the campaign trail, I see this idea of being a city councilor as community organizer. I am definitely a community organizer at heart. I think a good city councilor in this new system is someone who is organizing, is spending a lot of time in the community and empowering people and listening. And I'm going to bring my unique perspective, which is, you know, rooted in the labor movement. It's also as a worker, as a working mom. I'm someone that is new to this more established political scene. And so I think that's something that I'm bringing and is going to be a real strength for me, where I will question things and I'll say, you know, do we need to keep doing it this way from having that more unique perspective?
Yeah, I think for me, it helps kind of put the correct frame in place. Like as soon as you get called, your election gets called, like you start getting phone call after phone call after phone call from everyone who wants to be your best friend, right? And if you don't come out of a world where you are steeped in labor politics or working class politics, it can be very easy to fall into the siren call of the business lobby. And so stepping back, what I know as an economist of the working class is that, you know, you look at us, you know, the primary task we have ahead of us is to pass a budget in the next session to fund the government and kind of deal with some structural challenges. And I know that an $8.2 billion budget has room for labor in it, and you don't need to balance that on the backs of working people. And so I think there's going to be some very interesting labor struggles at City Hall right off the jump. And I'm really looking forward to standing on the side of labor when we get contracts resolved and kind of using the power of my office to do that.
You are both educators and have been active in teachers' unions, one K-12 and one in higher ed. So how do you hope to bring the importance of public education and support for teachers, students, and parents into this work as a city councilor?
Yeah, this is something I'm very passionate about. No one will be surprised to hear that. As a public school educator, as a mom, as a union member, part of it is by just being in the space. I know that so many folks are excited to see a public school educator hold one of these positions. By constantly educating and talking to folks about who want to kind of silo, think of our schools as like something to silo and not necessarily see how they are the heartbeat of the community, how important public education is and how much it needs to be supported. I also know that so much of this work is collaborating with electeds at many different levels. And so I have been doing this work already as a parent, pushing for us to fully fund our public schools better by continuing to have these conversations, find the allies, and also just attending meetings where I get to connect with teachers, students, parents, you know, showing up when Portland State's union is having a meeting, checking in my district and going to PTA meetings. Shortly after this, I'm going to be interviewed by a student at Franklin High School. So just, you know, making time to actually be on the ground, talking to folks in all of these different categories.
Yeah, Tiffany, I'm glad that you mentioned kind of like being interviewed by the students. You know, like as you can probably relate, your schedule and time gets filled up so quickly, but like there's nothing that brings me greater joy than making a little time to talk to a high school student about their project in civics, or a college student, which I did recently here. But yeah, just sort of from a programmatic standpoint, again, going back to the budget, if it's not in the budget, it's not a priority. And what I see with my eyes is efforts to kind of do economic development or some kind of real estate development or a, sort of a tax break type of model at the expense of like cradles to college commitments to education. And that to me is at the root, like that willingness to throw that aside is at the root of so many of our problems. And so I'm going to be kind of using the skills that I have and the expertise that I have, but also kind of bringing in these militant rank and file unions that have had it, right? They're over it, and bringing them into the discussion at City Hall through the committee work to kind of really turn up the heat. Cause I think, yeah, there's 12 of us, but sometimes those 12 need to be reminded of the urgency, you know, and some of the big projects that the city as a whole would love to have happen, that those should be conditional upon strong labor commitments and commitments to public education. And so I'm really looking forward to using that as a lever.
If you've just tuned in, this is KBOO Portland Labor Radio. We're talking with City Councilors-elect Tiffany Koyama-Lane and Mitch Green. Appreciate this program and find it useful. Please contribute to KBOO, community-supported, listener-sponsored, you know, non-corporate. Go to our website, kboo.fm, and donate. So you both know that the main issues of concern to Portlanders are housing and homelessness. How do you see your role as a city councilor in bringing the power of labor to solve the housing crisis?
Thank you so much for this question. On the campaign trail, I talked a lot about one of my neighbors who was, he's an elder, and he was unhoused in the Sunnyside neighborhood for 20 years. And a few years back, he told a bunch of us, oh, I'm ready to get into housing. And a bunch of us were so excited about this. We were like, sign me up as like a pseudo social worker. I'll help however I can. He was also signed a housing navigator through the Northwest Pilot Project. You know, this person is now in housing, still needs wraparound services in order to stay in housing. But I remember that housing navigator was incredible and also incredibly overworked and had to work another job to pay her bills. So a piece that we need to be talking more about is addressing the shortage of behavioral health workers. This is a workforce issue. We need to be building the bench for, you know, these folks that are doing some of the most challenging work in our city. We need training programs for mental health, addiction, substance use navigators, like substance use service navigators. We need better conditions for people doing this work, and this needs to happen immediately.
I love that. I would say that the scale of the problem is so large. Like I think the region as a whole has something like a 1 million housing unit gap by the next 20 years if we don't change our rate of production. So even just on the supply side, there's a big shortage. So the scale is so large that it's going to take like movement politics to get the solutions that we need and the commitments that we need to tackle that in any meaningful time frame, right? And to me, that looks like bringing together the labor movement with the climate movement, with tenant unions, student movements, as one coherent project, right? To demand things like social housing, workforce housing. You should be able to live where you work. And that portfolio of housing needs to be in the public hands. It needs to be administered and owned by the city, staffed by city employees who are unionized. And to me, that is how you bring together this coalition, because we have done it before. This is not new. We just need to cut out this kind of like public-private partnership mindset where you substitute in contractors for city employees.
Mitch, I noticed you didn't mention your plan for social housing. Do you want to talk about that?
So a big problem that we have right now is you have this so-called commitment to affordable housing, but it's just a label. It doesn't mean anything. By program design, affordable housing can be quite unaffordable for a lot of working class people. And what social housing does instead is it says, no, we're going to build this mixed income publicly owned building. And we are going to intentionally set the rent at your income level. So it's proportional to your income level. So it's truly affordable. 30 to 40% is what an affordability threshold looks like. And it's sort of a concept that might be familiar to your listeners, called from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. That is what social housing really is in principle. We can do it in Portland. And I think that we are going, and that's what I'm going to be fighting for.
In this new system of city council districts, districts 3 and 4, yours, will have their election cycle staggered. And this means you both will be up for re-election in just 2 years. What do you hope to achieve in that time, and how will you do it?
It's so hard for me to think about running another campaign. I know that that's something I will have to think about. I also have heard from folks that, you know, have done this many times. They said that folks are going to want to see some like physical things immediately, some physical improvements. They're going to want to see some roads closed. They want to see some like things that you can actually look at and see that they have changed. I mean, a lot of my priorities are addressing traffic violence in really some serious ways, doing something to protect our renters more. You know, we have 50% of Portlanders are renters. I've had some of my own students and their caregivers get evicted in the middle of the school year. This is something that is really important to me in supporting families. I also, you know, maybe this is a lot of different things, the teacher in me, the organizer in me. I'm also really focused on making sure that we start with some norms, getting on the same page. I'm not talking about months of doing that, but like we need to have some conversations and make sure that we have the same understanding of certain definitions, making sure that we know each other's values so we can find out where there's overlap and literally draw some Venn diagrams. And so I know that's where we need to start. I know the public is really anxious for us to get to work, but I also know that the public also wants us to get it right.
I'm a big believer of the idea that when you use power, you build power. And one of the things that I would like to do pretty early on is to take some of the environmental considerations in my district head on. And that's the clean energy infrastructure hub and sort of the Zenith, train that runs through. I would like to have city council kind of convene and look at what we can do to move that out of there as quickly as possible. That would, I think, satisfy the desires of a lot of folks in the environmental camp that were behind my run. And I feel like that's a big priority for groups like the Eco-Socialist Working Group of Portland DSA and 350 PDX and so many others. So that's a fight and I'm willing to have it. But I also agree that we need to be setting up a vision for the next couple of years and trying to get in place good norms that mean that we can keep power, I think, dispersed in a way that doesn't just automatically flow to the business lobby. I'm very interested in setting up rules of council operations that make that possible, making sure we don't get, testimony that stacks the deck against the lobbyists who are trying to get their own city council commissioners reelected and that sort of thing. And so, like, that's really important too. And that's a little less visible, a little less sexy, but it's very important. And then, of course, getting the social housing started. I don't think that we'll have it done in 2 years. I think that's pretty ambitious. But we can create the framework. We can create the legislation to make the city ready for, I don't know, a pot of money that might come from the state. We probably won't get anything from the federal government. You know, things didn't go in that direction. Trump has ideas and plans for Portland, but I think the state is a big opportunity to get some housing money, and they need that to kind of capitalize our social housing fund.
So some political forces in the city don't necessarily agree with your vision. Willamette Week, for instance, declined to endorse Tiffany because she wouldn't apologize for going on strike. What groups might attempt to pressure the council in a different direction, and what do they want?
Mitch mentioned business-centered lobbyists. Could probably include media outlets that some of those same folks own or have a lot of influence over, or influence because they are connected to them. I mean, those groups know who they are. I do want to focus on the fact that we're building something new, And anyone that watched my campaign closely knows that I love to stay positive, love to stay focused on what I know works, which is bringing in the community. And so part of my plan is to try and let a lot of that stuff slide off. I haven't hid the groups who I've sought their endorsements and who have supported this campaign. And I'm really excited to help give a voice to community members who have been boxed out of local politics. So I'm not hiding that at all. And I think I'm just going to keep bringing in the groups that have been boxed out, and people don't like that. It's okay. They can say they don't like that teachers went on strike and not explain more about that. That I can't really control if people are going to say those things. I'm just going to keep moving in the direction of supporting the community with integrity, and that's what I do.
Yeah, I think that you're always going to have a very strong business lobby that lobbies city council. That's just what it is, and that they will always be there. What I think though is interesting is the opportunity to have countervailing lobbying activity at the city that raises up working class issues. That can be through member driven organizations like DSA. It can be through labor unions. It can be through environmental PACs and the like. But I think the key piece, and why I mentioned it's so important to get the rules right for the council operations, is to make sure that we are giving adequate space for that representation and political pressure, which is a form of free speech, right? And make sure we're inviting in the folks who endorsed us, who want to see like transformational change in this city, bringing them into the committee work, letting them to kind of like be kind of partners at that table early on, instead of this process where city council has a backdoor meeting with some lobbyist that they may or may not report, and then they craft this like legislation and they present it to the public, and you have 2 minutes to say something about it, and it's already fully baked. That needs to change, and that's kind of what I want to see. That's what I'm going to put my energy toward.
City unions are currently negotiating their contracts with city management. As city councilors, you will have some sway in the final outcome, both because you will vote on proposed contracts and because you can use the bully pulpit and other tools of your office. How will you relate to city union bargaining? And if city workers decide to authorize a strike, how would you react to that?
Yeah, I'm very clear that I'm part of the labor movement, that labor is my family. I will listen to workers, support them, be on the line with them if they are forced to strike. And, you know, looking down the road, plan to be engaged before it gets to that place too. I know that we won't be sworn in until December 19th, but looking down the road, I want it to be something that I'm ongoing knowing about and being up in management's business, making sure that we're standing with our workers and supporting them. And I think about being a worker myself, and in the past, oftentimes looking to my own school board members who do hold power and influence. And I remember just feeling like, you know, you could say something publicly, you could support us, you could tell management to do things differently. And really wanting that. And I'll use my voice and my position in order to provide that thing that I was really hoping for myself.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see me on the line, no question. Being very, very vocal about why I'm on the line and the conditions that need to change for the strike to end and so on and so forth, but supporting it. I'm also going to, I'm an economist, and I know how to kind of speak in the language of the professional managerial class, if you will. Like I know how to undercut some of the arguments that say, oh, we have no choice but to cut X, Y, and Z around this contract, or, have this position. And so I can use that expertise to push back on that framing with management. We've got oversight powers in city council. The nice thing is we're not running any of these bureaus. We're not the boss. The city administrator is the boss, and we can use our oversight powers to compel the boss to behave a certain way. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, the city has its own lobbyist for the legislative agenda and, you know, doing business in Salem. As long as I have a voice at City Hall, I'll make it very clear that it's not acceptable to lobby against public sector unions' contracts and their interests at the state. It's unacceptable and it's disgusting. It has happened before, and we'll work to put a stop to it.
So a major part of being in office is constituent services. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, a DSA member, is known for excellent constituent services and even held a joint event with Detroit DSA and Labor Notes to help her constituents learn how to organize a union. How are you planning to approach constituent services, and how would you use it to build working class movement?
I love this question because it's getting me to think more too, and think about an area that I want to plan more around and research around. You know, I think as a candidate, even just 3 weeks ago, it can be so hard to think about staffing. And I remember folks leading up to Election Day were like, you should start thinking about who you might want to hire. I don't know how much folks know that we have been allotted one staffer each. And that person is supposed to do all the work. I was just telling someone, we get one chief of staff, and they're like, but they're not, why are they a chief of staff if they're not managing anyone else? They're just the staff. And then there is one person that the city has hired already who's supposed to do constituent services for all three of us in the district. And so I think these are a lot of conversations that we need to be having as a group of three. I want to learn more about it. I know personally, one of my favorite things and where I get the most energy is when I get to help empower other folks. So during the strike, one of my roles as a strike captain is I had 12 different schools that I checked in with each day and was helping the strike captain at each school gain more confidence in how to pump up their team, how to check in with how things are going, and to see the growth of those captains at each school and see them really blossom. Even at schools where I was like, oh my gosh, I'm pretty sure like no one here has ever been to any type of protest. And they're all like whispering, you know, by the end, to see them like shoulders back, like shouting about what they deserve. I feel really excited about thinking about constituent services in that way. I love this example of supporting constituents in how to be empowered by organizing themselves in a union. And I think that can be extended in other ways too, like this idea of supporting by empowering and connecting people with more information and tools.
Yeah. I mean, my approach to this, you know, yes, we are going to be a little understaffed. And that's something I think we're going to want to look at, because you can't really run an effective government where you have both constituent services and policy development with just one staff person. But setting that aside, even just working within the confines, I think there's two worldviews on constituent services. One of them is, you know, it's just a very transactional client relationship. It's like, okay, the constituents are my clients, and then I just, you know, I take feedback, and then maybe we do something about it, maybe not. But oftentimes your job is to tell them why we can't do something. There's another worldview that says the issue is that this person's an individual in society, and is not organized and is not part of a structure that's committed to like substantive democracy building. And I think what I would like to do as a leader in the district is as I engage with constituents, kind of like tease out their engagement with the community and politics as a whole, and then try to steer them towards making some inroads in their own organizing efforts. I mean, because they're already activated if they're talking to you, so you can take it a step further. And so maybe that's issues in the workplace. Maybe that's, you know, getting together a tenant union, or maybe it's you know, wondering why we can't fill potholes, right? And it kind of bringing them into this broader discussion. And so I really want to think about constituent services as an investment, actually, in the kind of the praxis, I guess, of the city.
I love that. Can I say one more thing on that same topic? I remember being really inspired hearing Joanne Hardesty recently talking about Angelita Morillo, who also is going into City Hall with me, a city councilor elect for the same district as me, District 3. And the way she talked about Angelita, like not just viewing folks as like, okay, now like you're taken care of, check mark, but really like checking back in with people, like moving more to a relational framework, making sure that folks really felt part of things, and also doing that extra, taking the extra step of saying like, oh, did you actually, were you actually able to connect with that person? How did that work? Can I get feedback? That's something that was really inspiring to me and is something that I hope that we can continue to do when we're in office.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. on KBOO 90.7. I'm Jamie Partridge from with my co-host Laura Wadlin, and we've been speaking with Portland City Councilors-elect Tiffany Koyama-Lane and Mitch Green. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.